speaker, Larry P. from Montrose.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Dee Dee and Pete for asking me to come down here and be with you, and to let you know that I'm happy to be sober today. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're anything like me, those two words never belong in the same room at the same time. I've never been happy about being sober. It never brought me a warm glow, you know. I mean, it always frightened me. And I'm especially glad to be here today because my head didn't win. My head didn't win. And my head's used to winning. My head loves to win. It insists on winning, you know. And one more time, my head didn't talk me out of going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's nice to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and see some friends. And some friends that I haven't seen for a long time. And I'm very, very proud to be an active member of my home group. And if you're new, I hope you will soon be an active member of your home group. Because there's a saying that goes around in Alcoholics Anonymous that the road gets narrower. I don't know about that, but it gets less crowded, that's for damn sure, you know. So we need. I am no big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe me, I am no big deal in AA. I am a coffee maker and a cookie lady. And I like that. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for over 12 years and not amount to a damn thing. So there you have it. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, you know. So, I guess the hearing impaired, I guess he's going to make $40 an hour tonight. I guess that's the deal. And we're going to make him earn his money. I guarantee you that tonight, you know. And there were some guys that over here at Lemon Grove that I met tonight, and they mentioned a story that they heard me tell. And I didn't remember the damn thing, but they certainly did. And just to let you know that being sober, does not mean that everything's going to be wonderful all the time. I did not rocket to any type of serenity or peace. I mean, the book says we're going to know peace. It doesn't say you're going to have the damn thing, but it says you're going to know it, you know. And what you're going to find out is you're going to know you don't have it most of the damn time, you know. So that's what you're going to know, you know. You're going to find that you're going to have three phases of your... there's three phases of alcoholism. One is the active phase when you're out there drinking. And the other two, one is what they used to call... they don't talk about it much more anymore, but it's called the dry drunk. And the other one is when you're sober and working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of the time, you'll be in between the latter two. And most of the time, you're thinking that you should be in the latter one always, you know. But most of the time, we're trying to deal with, now that we're sober, what are you going to do with me? You know, we know how to stop drinking. We've done it hundreds of times, you know. But now that I'm sober, what are you going to do with me? And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It ain't about getting sober here. You're sober when you come to us. And now we're going to show you how to live. Now that you're sober, we're going to show you what to do now that you're not drinking. And you're going to think that most of the time it's not enough. Because Alcoholics Anonymous, it will give you the same effects almost as alcohol, but slower. You know, it doesn't affect me like alcohol used to, but it's the second best. It's a damn good second, you know. And just to give you an idea of what kind of goop you have up here, which I think you're going to get a clue, which you already have pretty sure right now, but I was about, so this happened about a year and a half ago. And I've had a hell of a time holding on to jobs since I've been sober in AA. I mean, I come to AA, I had no skills whatsoever, and I proved that, you know. And, you know, I mean, I can get those jobs, but I can sure leave them just as quick as I get them, you know. And hanging on to them seems to be a problem. And last year, I had a simple little job. All I had to do was pick up and deliver medical equipment. Okay, and, you know, not a big scholastic deal, you know, one that I thought I could surely handle, you know, and all you got to do is pick the stuff up, and when they're done or they die, you pick it up, you know, and you take it back, you know. And so I was a week on the job, and feeling confident and already feeling underpaid. You know how we are. And damn them, you know. I had to go to the Long Beach Memorial Hospital and pick up a wheelchair. So I go up to the fourth or fifth floor and I open up this room and there's this little elderly lady and she's in my chair. And she's knocked out. I mean, she's knocked out cold and she's got her little shawl, her little muumuu on and her little, you know, and she's just knocked out and hell, I got a job to do, you know. Damn it, I'm a productive worker. Let's get this thing going, lady, you know. And meter's running, damn it. And so I said, okay, how am I going to get this lady out of my chair, you know? And there's this patient hoist right next to her. Bear with me now, you know. And I figure, you know, she's got the little sling around her, and I'm going, hell, how hard can it be? You know what I mean? You know us Alfies, boy, we can sum up a thing like that, you know, and make the worst out of a bad situation, man. And so I go, okay, let's just hook her up there, you know, and let's get her up in the air, and we'll move her over to the hospital bed here, you know. My God, let's go, let's get going. So I hook her up there, you know, and I start cranking, you know, and hell, she starts rising, you know. And all right, everything's going pretty good, you know, and she's up there. I get her up there pretty high, you know, and she's kind of just, she's hanging there. And I said, okay, now we got to get her over there, and let's make it in about two or three motions. We'll get some momentum here, you know. And she's up there, you know, and I go, one, you know, two, you know, and three. And I go to push her around, and I swing her around, and her leg hits the rail of the bed, and her damn leg falls off. Like, oh, my God, you know, and I see this damn leg, you know, and I'm not sure if it's real or false, you know, and I thought I cracked her in half, you know, and so there's the hinges on there, and I try to hook that thing up there, you know, and I want to look up her dress, but she's so damn old, you know, you know, but my girlfriend was rude to me, and I said, what the hell, you know? So I get under there like a photographer, you know, and I can't hook that damn thing up there, you know, and I don't know what to do, so I just, so I get out of there, you know, and I just leave it on her lap, you know, and I grab my chair, and I get ready to make my damn move out of there, you know, and I'm running out the damn door, you know, and the doors open up, and there's a doctor and a nurse, and he says, what the hell happened here, you know? And like any good Alfie, I said, hell, I don't know. Hell, I have no idea. You know? Leave it to the Alfie to deny everything, you know? Even if they got pictures. I don't know. I don't know. I said, but you may want to look at her leg, you know? Now, it ain't too far after that. It's about two or three weeks after that that Gloria gets a call from Central Office, and she says, there's a guy down at Central Office. He's down, and he's at the L.A. County Hospital, and he wants to talk to you about AA. So I go down to the L.A. County Hospital a couple weeks later, and I go up to the fifth or sixth floor, you know, and open up this room, and sure enough, there's a guy in the bed, and he's got his leg on the nightstand. He's got one leg, you know, and I go in there, you know, and he's been in and out of AA before, and he says, well, what kind of story do you got to tell a one-legged guy? And I says, hell, I can think of one right now, you know. You need to be moved around anywhere, you know. So, you know, if you're new and you're waiting for your story to be found in the book, don't sweat it, you know. Find your story in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to identify with anything in this damn book, try the doctor's opinion. Try more about alcoholism. Quit waiting to find your unique little story in the back of the book or at your little special interest meeting. Come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and find a little bit of your story in somebody and find out what that dude's doing, how to stay sober. Quit trying to find your complete dialogue in your story in one little guy's talk. Try to find something about how that guy's living and trying to find out how he's still doing it, and then watch him. God's given you a very lovely gift, and watch people in AA. People talk and they talk about AA, but I want to see how you're living. I'm watching you like a hawk. I'm tired of people telling me what to do, and then you go home and you see how they live, and it's totally against what they just got done talking about. I want to see you, pal. I want to see you in meetings. I want to see you doing the exact same thing you're up there telling me what to do. And you know what? I've been gifted by people in AA who do that. They do that. They're like you people. They're taking care of their home group. They're picking up chairs. They're making coffee. And these are the people I need to be around. I don't need to be around these goofs who are good for a year and they blow out. What about the people with 9 and 10 years who are still here doing the deal? That's what I want to see. Because it's up to AA to keep AA alive. It's up to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous to keep AA alive. And that's why I'm glad to see a room packed with AA members, old, new, and middle. That's a good sign. There's something going on here. And it ain't like this everywhere you go. You guys got a good deal here, man. And I feel privileged to be in a meeting like this. And, you know, my mom and dad, they're not the reason why why I started drinking. I had a great mom and dad, you know. I didn't have a terrified childhood that just drove me into drinking, you know. I had a goofy mom. She was a little Scandinavian lady, and she loved speed. Loved those diet pills, man. She'd eating those Dexies all damn night, you know, and she'd be out mowing the damn yard around 3 in the morning, you know, or you can see her, you know, hear her raking the neighbor's yard around 5 in the morning, you know, raking everybody's damn lawn, you know, and always busy doing stuff around the house and doing it fast, you know, and she was always out in the garage. She always liked to fart around in the garage, you know, I caught on at an early age that if I ever wanted any love or affection, I could find mom out in the garage around 4 in the damn morning, you know. I knew where to find love and affection, and she'd be out there, you know, taking my dad's bolts and screws and nuts and put them in little Gerber baby jars, you know, and then she'd put the lid on a piece of round wood so he can twirl the damn thing around and find it, you know. Just had his little hobby shop all made up, you know, and the old man was hep to that. He didn't spend a day out there, you know. I did not see him out there one day, you know, and because she was out there, and she's a wild lady, man. She loved the needlepoint, you know. I could hear her clicking and clacking all damn night, you know, and everything in that house had a cover for it, you know. Everything, you know. My dad's golf clubs had covers for it, you know. Toilet paper had little covers for it, you know. My sister used to have cats, and she'd knit them vests, you know. And just wild, you know, and packing those lunches all night long with that old Cut-Rite wax paper, you know, and you'd get up, and mom would be up all damn night, here, you know, and you'd take that, okay, you know. And to this day, every time my mom sees me, she demands that she says, you look hungry. You need some ham. I don't want no ham. You look like you need some ham. I don't want no damn ham, you know. You look hungry, you know. And she's always trying to feed me. She's starving to death, you know, and she thinks that I need something to eat. And she would always burn stuff, burn toast. And she'd bring me this burnt toast, and she'd go ahead and eat it. It's good for your gums, you know. Mom ain't got a tooth in her damn head, you know, and good for my gums, all right? But I love my mother, and I still do. I love my mom, and she was great to be. And to tell the diet was working, she was down to a stick. Blonde hair and eyes, just like that, you know. And she could get lost in the bathroom, man, just doing shit, you know. And my dad was a refinery worker, and my dad loved to drink. Dad made drinking look real good. He did. He was a happy drunk. You know, scary man when he was sober, but a happy singing the blues drunk, man. Always coming home with 2 or 3 guys who were his best friends, did not know their first name, you know. And my dad was a window climber. He was always sneaking out of his own damn house, you know. And as a kid, you wonder what the hell's going on. It's hard to have respect for your dad when he doesn't have keys to his own home, you know. You wonder what the hell's going on there, you know. Sneaking in and out of his damn window, and it was my bedroom window that I could feel that greasy refinery boot as he's coming in and out of that bedroom window, you know, and he snuck in there one night, you know. I felt that boot, and he snuck in there one night. I said, my God, Dad, why don't you have Mom make you some keys? Shit, you know. Hell, she's up anyway, you know. I think I hear the lawnmower going now, you know. She probably ate the keys with her teeth, you know, just grind you out of set, you know, and knit you a key ring to go with it, I'm sure, you know. But get the hell out of my window, you know, and so I moved out of that bedroom, and then I started sleeping with my grandfather, who was a piece of work. Gramps was a Scandinavian, and he always told me that I look better than both my sisters. That'll make you feel like a champ, you know. And you're going to go to sleep with Grandpa. I don't think so, you know. There won't be no York and Bork in the night, Grandpa, you know. Over there looking at the hell he's going to do tonight, you know. And just like clockwork, every night around midnight, old Grandpa would be doing his rosary. And you figure, every night this guy's doing a rosary, what the hell is he doing every day, you know? And he'd be, and you hear the juggle of the beads, and then jingle some more beads, and then there'd be silence. And then old Grandpa would walk over to a sock drawer, open up that sock drawer, and you hear this pop open that. Exactly. Alfies know what that sound is, okay? All the Al-Anons in the room go, cricket, you know? Alfies know what that sound is, man. We can hear a captive seal in L.A. right now, man, you know? And yeah, and I heard that, my eye went open like that, you know? I hear this. Both eyes were open like that, and Gramps tilts that old peach brandy down, which is another sound we love, you know? And he'd come back to bed, you know, and he'd be quiet, you know, and then you'd hear this. And I'd look over there, and there's Grandpa sanding his bunions down, okay? I'm about to choke the son of a bitch because I can't get any sleep anywhere, you know? Mom's up all night mowing the damn neighborhood. Dad's stuck in the window with one of his best friends, and Grandpa's over here rubbing himself raw, you know? And I'm wondering where in the hell a kid can get some sleep, you know? To this day, I want a full night's sleep, you know? I got a lively head. My head kept me up all night long talking to me. My head wants, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, my head wants to chat. What the hell you want to talk about, man, you know? Oh, we're going to talk about your past. My God, we just talked about that the other night. We're going to go over, yes, we are, you know? And my head goes on, and man, you know, I've always wanted a good night's sleep, you know? And sure enough, you know, so there's old Gramps standing himself raw. And that's when I started sleeping out on the couch, man, watching those old movies, Cisco Kid and Sky King and stuff like that, and getting curious about what's in my old man's thermos and stuff like that. And it never failed me. Same thing was in my thermos, and was in there every year, some of that old port wine. That tawny port wine in that thermos, man. I remember the smell of that, and I remember the taste of it, man. And I'm just a normal, goofy kid. I haven't been terrorized into alcoholism. I have a, you know, I've been real simple. I like tree forts and dirty magazines, you know. Just give me a good tree fort and a dirty, to this day, that sounds pretty good, you know. And I liked it then, you know. And at this time, my dad used to play that old Drifter song, Up on the Roof. Boy, and there I was, up on that damn tree fort, man. Man, away from everything, man, and looking down around, and I love being in that tree fort. And the reading was good. And I'm doing everything that all these other goofy kids in the neighborhood are doing. I'm playing the sports, I'm going to school, but they seem to be happy with that. They seem to be content with that, quote, normal living. I'm doing the same thing, and there's got to be a little more than this. You know, I've always, you know, it seems like I've always been born looking for an answer. I've always been curious and wanting to be discovered. I always want that secret desire that one day you're going to be discovered. Little did I know that it'd be on the streets of L.A. stone drunk, but I was discovered nonetheless, you know. And I've always wanted to be something, because I'm sure that what I am ain't enough. You know, and around 10 years old, my dad came into that bedroom of mine, and he told me that I was going to have a baby brother. Man, that Alfie imagination. I started planning for that kid brother. Start saving up my baseball cards and oiling up my gloves and thinking about how me and that kid brother are going to go to the drag races and stuff like that. 9 months later, my dad come into that same bedroom and he told me that my baby brother died. I did not have any compassion for my mom. I don't remember saying, God, Dad, is there anything I can do? How's she feeling? I did something that was going to follow me to this day. You know, we go through temper tantrum in a rage in a New York second. Boom. And I went after my old man. For the first time in my life, this young man has physical contact with his father, and it's not a handshake. It's the first time you make or approach your old man and you go to hit him or something like that. And I remember how I felt. I remember what he did, too. You know, he beat the hell out of me. What the hell are you doing? And I remember yelling at him, you promised me. You promised me, Dad. And from that point on, that was it. Because I've been slowly building up a wall between me and that old man and me and that family, and that was going to be it. That was the last brick in a wall. And from now on, whatever family says, Larry, don't trust it. If that's what family is, you can have it, man. And I already got my little resentment going on, man. And around 10, 11 years old, there was four of us who were across the street in a garage, and I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, man, I felt like I should have been feeling all along, man. That book describes God the same way that I felt that day. It did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And it was going to continue doing for me what I couldn't do in any given situation. Every time, man. It just loosened up those shoulders and warmed up yourself, and you just stood you out there and you go, yes, man, this is it. This is how you're supposed to be feeling. Screw getting a home run. You know? And no longer was it ever necessary for me to ever have any goals or aspirations from that point on. From the moment of that first drink, it was no longer necessary for Larry to wonder what he's going to do when he grows up. What's he going to do after high school? Is he going to be a Navy man? Is he going to, you know, what's he going to do? What are you going to do? None of that. All my questions were answered. They were no longer even thought about. But more important, just as important as how that first drink affected me, was more just as equally as important was what happened the next day. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope you identify with this, was that sobriety was never going to look the same. It never looked the same, and it never was going to be enough. I would always remember how that drink made me feel. And at any given moment, I could know that I could pick up a drink and have that feeling there. And I would not have to think or worry or do anything, man. It was always right there, and it worked every time, man. And I didn't head off the skid row that next day, but I never thought any more about what I'm going to be or what should I do about life. The questions of life were answered, man. And come time to get into high school, I didn't have any peer group. And I didn't know what the hell was I going to do. And when I got into high school, I found a group of people that made me feel more a part of life than the people did in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the lowriders. Summer after my freshman year, I found the lowriders, and all we had was big hair. You know, I had a hair that looked like a damn tumbleweed, man. It was so big like that, and I'd drink that gin and eat those reds, and we'd bounce around all day listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs, and God, I loved it, man. I had a little, it wasn't about a couple weeks ago at work. I'm driving around in my plumbing truck, and I heard the Four Tops. I started thinking in my damn truck, man. You know, I loved it. I had a little Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she used to curl her hair up real big, you know, and she'd get these soup cans. And sometimes that old soup was still in them, you know, and she'd curl up her hair real big, you know, and paint her eyebrows real big and get on these sweaters and put them on backwards where the buttons are. And I'd get my hair real big and wear these white Town Craft shirts with these black khaki pants and these 6-inch pointed shoes. And you could see my hair before I did when I was around the damn corner, man. And we'd drive around, man, up and down the damn streets all night long, listening to the Four Tops and the OJs or that Vibersonic going, you know, and just bouncing all damn night. And everything I wanted was in that car. Everything I ever needed in life was in that car, man. And I knew that I was going to go through life in that car. I found what I'd been looking for in that car, man. And I loved the way I felt, man. I remember it was time to get into driver's education. And they usually have the biggest coach in the world driving with you, you know. And it was my turn to drive, and he said, Thomas, get in the car. So I get my hair into the car like that, you know, and we're driving around, and he has me parallel park. So I parallel park, and he thinks I'm doing pretty good. And he says, you know what, it's kind of hot out. He says, why don't you go to the Jack in the Box, pull in there, and I want to buy everybody some Pepsi. I know, that's a pretty good idea. What I forgot was 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then call Tylenols. These babies are great. These are like a pitcher of martinis in a capsule, man. You know, I've been a good guy. I'd just been drinking and using heroin up to that point. I haven't been bothering anybody. And, man, I took four of those things, and, you know, you take them all. The guy gave me four, I took four, you know, because what if one don't work? You know, you take them all, you know. You don't want to be caught with anything. You take them all, you know. So 10 minutes go by, and I think, he ripped me off. I knew it. I'm glad I took them all, you know. So we go to pull into this Jack in the Box. I'd forgotten all about that bunk dope I got, you know, and we pull in there, you know. And all of a sudden, boom, those things nail me, man. My ears are ringing. I start sweating, you know, and I go to ask the coach, you know, what we're to get. I think, you know, did you want me to get Pepsis or something like that? And I turn to him and I go, rrr, 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 and I, my God, I lost my voice. My vision is gone, and I'm starting to feel hypnotic. My eyes are in the back of my head like that, you know, and I can't see a damn thing, man. I'm trying to open up my eyes and, oh, man. And my voice is gone, you know. I'm thinking I can talk all right, but I'm, you know. And he says, pull up to the damn puppet and order some Pepsis, you know. Hell, I can't see the damn puppet, man, you know. All I can hear is that, can I have your order, please, you know. So you start honing in for that, you know. Then I have your order, please, and you're going around, and I finally see the menu, you know, so you go for that, and I ran over the damn puppet, and bam, like that, and I see that old puppet's head hanging over like that, you know, and those honkies, don't you just, you want to talk, yeah, I want to ask the puppet to come out and drive for me, I think, you know, be my designated driver for the day, you know, and the cops come, and they arrest us, you know, and they throw me on the hood of the car, and they shatter my hair all over the damn parking lot. You know, and they arrest me, and, you know, and I don't drive till I'm 30. Big deal, man. Big deal. Now I'm riding shotgun. And if there's two things made for Alkies, one of them was alcohol, and the other one had to have been the mirror. There's something about an Alkie and a mirror, man. I mean, we see that mirror. I mean, oh, my God, there he is, you know. And it's yourself, you know. Look at you. My God, you know. And the more you drink, the better looking you get, you know. You start getting bigger and beefier, and my God, you get your eyes get bluer and your hair gets bigger, and you're just wonderful, you know. And there I was riding shotgun, man. I'm riding shotgun, you know, and I'm drinking that old gin, and I'm looking out that damn, and I see myself in that mirror, and I go, oh, man, you're going to get him tonight. You know, we're going to score tonight, man. You're taking a shot off that mirror? Yeah, man, you're 110 pounds, you can't lick a stamp, you know. But you're going to go get him tonight, you know. My God, you know. And I love to dance, man. Once I started drinking, I love to dance, man. I'd be dancing all night with these little cha-chas, you know. And I remember this one night, you know, we're dancing, you know, and then somebody told me that somebody stole a jar of Reds from my best buddy, Pooch. And then they threw me in the back seat, and we were going out to Whittier to Pico Rivera. We were going to get this guy. And so I'm in the back seat, and we're driving around, you know, and I got this little piece of pipe in this magazine. We're going to drive out there, man, and we're drinking and stuff like that, and we're listening to Smokey. And I thought, yeah, yeah, we pull up into that damn hamburger stand, and those guys go, Larry, there you are. He's in the back of the stand back there in the parking lot. And I see this guy back there, and I said, all right, man, let's go get him, you know. And I don't know about you, but when bad things happen to me, they take forever. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like the film stops, and it goes quick, and it just goes real slow. Fast things happen like that, you know. I mean, you know, when you ever had a good week, it goes like that, you know. But when you're having a bad week, it just, my God, it seems like a month, you know. And I knew something was going on is when they said, all right, Larry, go get him, and I'm going out the car by myself, okay. And I see this guy in the back of the dang parking lot, and he's about 6'6", about 280 pounds. His feet are this thick, you know, and I'm going after him with that damn magazine, with that pipe in it, you know. And all of a sudden, I knew something was wrong because click, slow motion. And I see myself running after this guy, going to hit him, and the pipe fall out of the magazine. That old boy kicked my ass for 2 days, it seemed like, you know. But the Alkie that I am, I'm thinking, you know, when this guy's done, I'm going to kick his ass, you know. And all I could see was his boot, you know, just like that, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, what does this guy think's happening to him? This little white man coming after him with a Life magazine, you know. What am I going to get out of here? You get on back to Pico Rivera taking his dope like that, you know. What does he think I was going to do with that magazine, you know? Just crazy, you know. But I love my life, man. I knew that me and Pooch and Loopy were going to bounce off into the sunset forever, man. I knew it. And come 1969, everybody's going places. A lot of my buddies are going to Vietnam. A lot of my buddies are going to Chino and Tehachapi. A lot of them are turning hippie and going up to Big Sur and Colorado and all that nonsense. And yeah, I'm wondering what the hell I'm going to be, you know. So I decided, well, I'll go back to Detroit. So I head back east. So I wind up in Phoenix. There I am on Phoenix. And Phoenix got real cowboys and Indians. I'm over there on North Central and Buckeye Road at the Apache Motel. The blonde lowrider in Phoenix, you know. And my drinking's starting to take on some weird characteristics that I'm starting to notice. My whole personality is getting very weird now. It's like whoever I'm around, I start acting like in a matter of minutes. And I go to the wagon wheel bar, where else? You know, we're going to go Cactus Inn, and I'll be sitting there, and I'll have a couple Boilermakers, and old Ernie will come up next to me and go, "Hi, how are you?" And I'll take a shot, and I go, "I'm doing fine. How are you?" You know, where the hell did that come from? You know, I'll go down to this little Japanese bar in Gardena, and I'll be sipping some whiskey, and some little guy goes, "Hi, how are you?" And I'm doing fine. How are you? You know, I don't know who the hell I am. You know, and I'm just, you know, whoever comes around me, I think, well, I better start acting like them. You know, and I'm just weird because I'm getting like that sober. I'm getting really weird sober. And I start drinking that old Crow whiskey, and I start writing prescriptions is what I start doing. And I start writing prescriptions down there for Seconal and Nembutal and Tuinol and Obitrol, and you name it all, I wrote it all, you know. and tried to take it all, you know. And I ran those things for a while. We had a good deal going. We were running them wild, and they caught up with me. And I spent 2 years down there in an institution in southern Arizona. And I come out of that institution at the age of 21 in 1972, bound and determined that what happened to me was because I was a teenager. Chalk it off to being a kid and hanging around a gang. But something else is happening to me in my life, which is why I'm in this room right now. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear it said a couple different ways. And one of them is that people used to have a life, they started drinking, it got bad, and they come to AA. And then there's another group of people who say they had a life, they started drinking, it got bad, and then it stopped working, and then they come to AA. And in 1972, at the age of 21, it stopped working. I did not come to AA. That was not my first thought. Uh-oh, better come to AA, it ain't working. For the first time in my life, my drinking's got my attention. That thing that used to work like that, it ain't working no more. That magic that I used to get with just a half pint, I can't. That happy spot that I could just slowly get to, I can't get to. And I start frantically trying combinations of things just to find a brief moment of relief. Because now I'm feeling the same when I'm sober as I am when I'm drunk. And there's physical drunkenness, but there is no mental drunkenness. It still feels the same. And I don't know what the hell to do. I ain't getting no relief. All I'm getting is, boom, a phenomenon of craving, and I'm off and running, and I'm blacking out, and I'm waking up 2 or 3 days later going, what the hell happened? I was almost there. Now I got to take a drink to get these shakes off, and that's all I'm going to have is a couple cans of Old English, and I'll be all right. And I go to have a couple cans, and boom, I'm gone again. I don't know nothing about a phenomenon of craving. I don't know nothing about that. And I don't know what to do, because I can't find that spot. And the only thought that I have is that it worked once, it's got to work again. And the reason that I tell you that story about being a lowrider is because that was the only memory that I had. That if I could get it to work like it did in 1965 in the back of that Chevy, I know I can get it to work again. And I know the next time will be like that. I know it. I'll cash everything in on that next drink. Whatever good I've built up, whatever thing that I'm trying to overcome, I will cash it in on that next drink every time. Because I know the next time it's going to bring me relief, like in 65. And every time I cash it in, and every time it's not that thing. You know, one more attempt and one more failure. Countless vain attempts. I love it when our book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the things that we do prior to getting here, ad infinitum. Scotch the brandy, different kinds of wine, different kinds of books, self-help books, Senate. But this isn't happening in a matter of 2 weeks. They're talking about a part of an alcoholic's life, which is the most desperate part of our life, when we're trying to get that thing to work, and we know that we can. We know that something else, it has to be something else, that it ain't our drinking. That's one of the most desperate times of an alcoholic's life, is when they start naming that stuff that we're trying to do. They're talking about some desperate parts of our life. You know? And I don't know what to do. And in 1974, my probation officer, I'm back here in L.A., he sends me out to Camarillo, and he's tried anabuse, and I'm drinking on that, and he's tried therapy, and I'm just goofy on that, and he sends me to Camarillo to be observed. And they like what they seen, because they kept me there for 13 months. And I come out of Camarillo, bound and determined that what was happening to me, would never be a cure for, and that I was to be like everybody else that leaves that place. And like they've told us, we will not operate out in society without some type of mood-altering chemical, i.e. Thorazine, Prozac. We're going to need something to round off the edges, because just being sober ain't enough. I drank because of the way that I felt when I was sober. I couldn't stand the way that I felt when I was sober. I never felt enough, and I was always afraid, and it never got better. and people would tell me to shape up and sober up and stop drinking and you'll be all right. People of all walks of life. And every time you're talking to them, you're saying, man, I've been there, I've done that. Don't you understand that that's why I drink? Is a way that I feel when I'm sober? It drives me to drink every time again, man. And I'm left out there for 2 months. And I'm arrested in downtown Los Angeles for being publicly intoxicated, a violation of probation, a public nuisance. A public nuisance. You know, that's what dead dogs in the gutter are. They're public nuisances. And that's what I am. I'm a public nuisance. And they send me out to a wayside one more time. And in 1975, I'm in the South Bay Courthouse. And they're starting to transfer a bunch of us to different jails, Wayside and Tehachapi and Chino. And we're all out there, and there's about a holding tank of 150 guys. And they start naming off some guys and say, you're going to Tehachapi. So-and-so and so-and-so, you're going to Chino. Larry Thomas, you're going to AA. Where in the hell's that? You know, I never heard of that place out in the desert, you know. And they said, Larry Thomas, come to the gate. And over there at the holding tank is a Scottish man with a patch. He says, Eyelash. He says, my name is Alex. Are you Larry Thomas? And I said, yes. He says, come with me. You're going to AA. And I figure, I'm not chained to anybody. And I'm not in a black and white car, you know. And this little pirate takes me six blocks away in a lime green Plymouth Valiant to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Took me six blocks away, and he walked me into a place called the Torrance Lamita Alano Club. I'd never seen that word before. Alano? What the hell's an Alano Club? Alano. Is that, maybe it's a Samoan bar. I don't know. It's an Alano Club, you know. And he walked me into this Torrance Lamita Alano Club, and he starts introducing me to people. He started introducing me to a lady named Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and a little lady named Moose. And I says, what the hell am I doing here, man? You know, everybody's got a nickname and a tattoo, you know. And little Moose come running after me. She was from Louisiana or something. She come running after me. She goes, hi, my name is Moose. She says, I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are, Moose. I, you know, hell, I'm not it. That's for damn sure, you know. And then this big transvestite snuck around me. You know, they are sneaking around somewhere. And he snuck around me, you know. And he says, hi. He says, I can't wait to take you to candlelight meetings. I said, I don't think so, you know. No, you know, not for the first year anyway, you know, so. You must be the magic of the program, you know. Let me get all my chips, big fella, you know, and, you know, what the hell am I doing here, you know, I said, my God, if that's Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't want no part of that. You know, if that's the effect of that big blue book, I'm not sure I want to dabble in that mess, you know. And I was immediately out of there. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days to get drunk. 60 days to get drunk. 90 days to get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin again. Wondering why I wasn't having a spiritual experience. And every time I came back, I was desperate. And every time I came back, I wanted to not get drunk again. Every time I came back, I wanted to not drink again. And I would sit in these rooms. And I would stay here for a month or 2 months. And then the thought would come to my mind. In the back of my mind, I would say, you know, if you ever want to drink, you'll know what to do. If you ever feel like drinking, you'll know what to do, Larry. You don't need all this stuff. In the back of my mind, I'll know what to do. Now, that's a hell of a place for any information for an alcoholic to be, is in the back of his damn mind, you know, because you wouldn't believe what's in front of it, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to keep, my primary purpose is to stay sober, is to keep that right up front. Now, how does it get from here to here? It takes about 2 weeks with no meetings for me. It takes about 1 week for some people. Sometimes it takes a day. But all it takes is for an alcoholic, for him to stop, you've got to get my rear to it first. And you taught me how to do that. You taught me how to do that. And every time I'd come to those rooms and I would leave, I always wanted to not drink again. I never had any idea about staying sober. That sounds too long. Staying sober, you say 24 hours a day, I know you mean forever. I know you mean it, you know. Never could admit that I was an alcoholic. Never could admit that I was powerless. Never could admit that I was, and as long as I remain with some kind of power, that means I'm going to manage that part of my life and I'm destined to fail. But as long as I remain powerless over me being an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable, only then will Alcoholics Anonymous work for me. I have to be powerless in order for Alcoholics Anonymous to work for me. I can't get any power back and expect it to work. AA is my power. And with Alcoholics Anonymous, you've taught me how to stay sober with their principles and manage my life with the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never knew that. And every time I come in and out of these rooms, and every time I call Alcoholics Anonymous, AA would come and get me. Every time I call AA, you people would come and get me. Never once did you come to that little motel room and said, "You've been here before. I'm sorry, man, you robbed the Alano Club. We can't bring you back. I'm sorry, you threw a cup at the speaker. I'm sorry, we had to kick you out last night. I'm sorry, man, you can't come back. You've been here before, Larry." Every time you guys come and get me, you ask me the only thing, "You want to stay sober this time?" And I go, "Yeah," and you come with me. And in 1980, there's this guy doing his 12-step work. Don's always trying to get me sober. He's always there, man. And in 1980, I'm over at the Don Hotel over there in Wilmington. I'm on the second floor. It's a Thursday afternoon. I hear this, and my God, who in the hell's that? "Larry, it's Don." "Oh, man, it's that guy from AA." I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here now, you know. And I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half. I'm already sipping on that thing. I got the only two things I need in my room. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. Got that little can of sardines going for vitamins, you know. Watching that little hot TV. Got my army fatigues on and my long hair and got my lawn chair. I'm all ready to dig into the day, man. And I'm wondering why the hell he ain't at work. "Larry, it's Don. Can I come in?" I go, "Yeah, come on in." And Don's got this new guy, Herbie. Herbie's got 2 days. Herbie's on fire. Herbie's got the AA bug, all right? Herbie's going around that, "Oh, Larry, man, you don't got to..." Do you imagine that? I think that I've been letting Don down. Because all this time I'm thinking he's coming to see me because I'm an alcoholic. You want to know about Alcoholics Anonymous? He was coming to see me because he was an alcoholic. His only job was to drop off the message. He knew what the hell I did with it. His only job was to drop it off. And you can bet your bottom dollar he wasn't thinking about his phone bill when I was in front of him. His only job was to tote that message to me. And I'm feeling sorry for him. And I told Don with all the sincerity that, "I don't want what you have, Don. I don't want what you got. But if I ever get that bad, I'll know where the hell I, you know where to go. Just get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do, Don. Let me do what I want to do. The cry of this alcoholic my entire life, man. Just let me do what I want to do." Which is why I'm here tonight. Me doing what I want to do when I want to do it. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. Nobody's going to tell me how to get sober, what to do with my life. It'll be a cold day in hell before I get another man in AA a cup of coffee. It'll be a cold day in hell before I pick up a chair in a meeting or clean up a room. It'll be a cold day in hell before I do that kind of crap. And if you're new, I pray that you have that cold day in hell. I hope you get down so damn low that AA looks like a step up. Because every time I come back to you, no matter how down I was, AA still looked like a step further down. My pride was telling me I deserved better, that it wouldn't work. And the last time I went out there, AA, for the first time in my life, it looked like a step up. It looked real good when I come back to you. Because for 2 years, I'm out there living in that hell where you can't get drunk and you can't get loaded and you can't live and you can't die and you think you've been to AA. And you always do what you do when you get like that, to live on those streets. And I'm down there at the mission over there in Wilmington. May 1st, I see myself go by a Woolworth window, and I see myself in this window with my long hair and my damn little rented coat from the Goodwill, and I said, "What the hell happened to my dreams? All I wanted to do was be a cameraman. How come I'm always sobering up and getting drunk? How come I can't get beyond the thought? The idea of not drinking has never entered my mind. What the hell am I going to do?" And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you have a trouble staying here, you may leave us, but we will never leave you. Because somehow, someday, when you least expect it, you're going to think about that goof in San Diego with the tie on. Or you're going to think about the lady taking the cake or the people that work in this meeting. You're going to think about somebody in AA because the seed's been planted. And if you ain't alky, don't worry about it. It's only planted in alkies. It's only planted in alkies, and I couldn't get that bald-headed carpenter out of my mind. I'd be on those streets, and I'd get that little bottle of wine that I panhandled all day today, and I'd do the sound heard round the world. And I'd tap that seal, and I'd go to throw that damn wine back, and there's Don. I hadn't thought about that guy all damn day. I didn't think about him that much when he was sponsoring me, man. Now every time I'm drinking, I'm thinking about these goofy people in AA. And I can't get you out of my mind. on a May 2nd of 1982, I'm desperate and I want to get sober, but for the first time in my life, I can't deny the fact that no matter how goofy you people looked, you were staying sober. And I just prayed that God, that Don would come and get me and that I would stay sober and I would work the steps and maybe not look like you. Now I blend right in, it looks like, you know. And so I got on the phone and I called central office. And who do I get? I get Don. I go, Don, this is Larry. I'm down here at the mission. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He says, no, you little son of a bitch. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. If you want to stay sober, you get your rusty rear down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you. He says, that sign says we care. It doesn't say we're going to take care of your ass. And he hung up. And I said, my God, what the hell's wrong with that guy, man? He used to be so nice, you know. And I took the longest walk of my life that day. It was only 10 damn miles, but it seemed like forever. And I took a walk that day, and I stood up that Thursday night, and I sweated out with you that day, and I puked it out with that day, and I hallucinated with you, and I stood up at the Thursday night meeting, and I said, my name is Larry Thomas, I'm an alcoholic. And for the first time in my life, I felt like a member of AA, because for the first time in my life, I was here because we were here. I had a common bond with you. My common welfare right today is to stay sober with you. And for once in my life, I was eye to eye with you. And I could see it, and I liked it. And I didn't care what you looked like. I didn't care what I looked like. I was there for the same reason you were there for that brief hour and a half, and that was to stay sober. And you people were doing that. And that's why I'm here today, because I want what you have, and you people have shown me how to do that, man. You people have shown me how to live. And for my first 2 years, I was stone crazy. Just I got about 2 years and I got this damn awful complacency where I didn't think, I mean, I used to think that when I was 2 years sober, my God, look where I used to be and look what I'm at, and my God, I don't see any further work necessary to you know. I'm the guru of the club. I've got 2 years. I can quote, I can dance, and I know where the girls are. I got enough chips for everybody, you know. What the hell am I supposed to do, you know? And then, just as all these Alano clubs, I hate these damn Alano club sayings, easy does it. And then there was one that just nailed me. And it said, fake it till you make it. And I said to myself, my God, what do you do if you're a phony? I've been faking it my whole life. And now I'm the worst little image I've ever gathered in my life. And I've always had an image to hide behind, whether it be a little lowrider, a little loser, a little dope fiend. I had the worst image of my life. I was a sober member of AA. Where for an hour and a half, you come to a meeting and you're wonderful. Half hour before meeting time, you get your AA face on and you come down here and you pour coffee and forget names. Half hour after the meeting's over, you go home and die. And you try your waking moments to work an honest program dishonestly. And then you come back here for an hour and a half and be wonderful. What? How you doing? Just great. The program works great, you know. And you're living the biggest lie of your life. And everybody around you knows it. Because you're secretly sitting in these meetings and you're seeing guys that you sponsor, lives are flourishing because they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Everybody around you looks like the program is working immaculate. And you're sitting in these rooms at the same meetings dying. And you think you're doing AA. The miracle of that is that you're in AA when you have that realization. Thank God you're not in the bar having that effect. Thank God you're in a meeting and that will happen on and off again. You would think you should be someplace you're not in AA. And pray to God you're around a sponsor or in AA when that happens. Because it's just another corner for us to turn. That's all. And we dig in. Anybody can come to a meeting when they feel good. What about when it gets tough out there? I used to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and think it would shield me from life's little bullets. And what it does is stick you smack dab in the middle of life and you better have a program because they don't care. They don't care. They just want you to dig the damn ditch, goofy. You people care. And I come back to you people tonight and tell you thank you for my life. Thank you for the things that you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you for the tunnels that I've been in AA. And I've had some tunnels, because it's with those tunnels and coming out the other side of those tunnels, I can say, yeah, you were right, it does work. How many people get in those tunnels and they say, bullshit, it ain't working. My God, the miracle's on the other side of the tunnel. Tough it out. Get on the other side of that damn tunnel. Dig in. Talk to your sponsor. Pick up that goof and take him to a meeting. Even if you don't like him, take him to a meeting and get there. Watch yourself come out that other side of that tunnel and you go, yes. That's how I got faith in AA, was going through those tunnels. and I can be ready to go through another one. My little girl, my little Lauren's going to be taken away from me. Her and her mom have divorced me for a couple years, and I've seen her on a regular basis, and now they're going to move away, and it's ripping me apart. Because I love that little girl like you taught me how to love that little girl, and I don't want to see my little girl go. I don't want to be with my little baby. And you people told me how to stay here and be with these meetings, and it hasn't happened yet. Don't project, Larry. It hasn't happened yet. And I love my life in AA. The miracle of my life today is that I'm with you. And from the time I was 13 to the time I was 30, people have always been trying to do something about Larry's head. Let's work on his mind. Let's work on his emotion. Let's work on his alcoholism. Let's work on... And they've all tried it from the head down. The miracle of AA, if you're new, is we don't want your head. We don't want your mind. We want the only decent thing left you got. We want your feet. That's all we want. We're going to train your feet. AA has trained my feet, because when I'm in the shower and I'm going, I'm not going to go to that meeting. He's there. She's going to be there. He's going to be there. Hi, my name is Larry. I'm an alcoholic. Totally against my will. Alcoholics Anonymous is the longest thing I've ever done against my will, which is why it works so damn good. Go totally against my will, and it works great. And if you're new, I wish you desperation. I hope you get a sponsor like I got. I hope you get one who's out there doing it, and you can see him fail, and you can see him doing it. Not somebody who's a god or goo. So watch that old man fail, and watch that guy with 34 years, your sponsor, at that meeting. My home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower. My sponsor is Johnny, and I watch him have tough times, and I watch him have good times, but most of all, I see him in meetings. I see him in meetings, and he's there, and that's what I want. I want to be sober in meetings so that I can handle life's little bullets, so that I can be there. And the miracle of when you work these steps is something happened to me when I made these amends. There's something about making those amends. There was a girl in my life that I had to make amends to, and I sent her a letter. I wrote her a letter. I didn't go out and date her and see her if I could go to bed with her. I sent her an honest letter, and she read the letter. But over her shoulder 6 years ago was her mother, who was reading the letter. And her father was a drunk. He was a bad drunk. 2 months ago, I'm talking in Manhattan Beach, and I get done with my talk, and there's a man that come up to me, and he says, "Hi, my name is Tom Proctor." He says, "You don't remember me. I'm Fritzy's dad." He says, "I've got 2 years sober, Larry." He says, "I wanted to come and thank you." He says, "Fritzy's mom read that letter and gave it to me." And he says, "I read what happened to you in AA." And he says, "I seen you when you were at your worst. I seen you when you beat up my girl, and I seen when I had you arrested for doing it." He says, "I've seen what you were like, and I read that letter, and I'm just down here visiting, and I wanted to catch a meeting, and I didn't know you were going to talk." But he says, "I've been sober because of that letter." I didn't say, "Oh, thank you, Tom, thank you, thank you." I knew I had to take that man outside and make amends to him. You see, it was not only her that I affected, but people that she was living with. Her mother and father were affected by that too, and I had to make amends to that guy. He gave me the biggest hug, and he says, "Man, I'm so glad I've seen you. I love my life today." That mother of mine that I bloodied her nose when I was coming out of those institutions, I got to make amends to. That father that I got, and I owe all my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. The good, the bad, the ugly, I love my life in AA. And if you're new, I wish you desperation. I hope you're so desperate that you do things in Alcoholics Anonymous that you know won't work for you. And may God be with you. But more important than that, I hope you do things in Alcoholics Anonymous like I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous and that you've done, and find a loving God as He's expressed Himself in this group tonight. And I hope you feel that. And come on back and tell us how you did it. Thanks.